Predictions are dangerous.
We absolutely need more inventory.
The Fed doesn't actually have a lot of tools to regulate inflation.
That cash is dried up.
Wow, is my first thought, Bruce.
If both parties don't win, it doesn't happen.
The Real Look. Trending news.
G'day. Today's Wednesday, April 10th. I'm Bruce Hardy.
And I'm Chase Williams.
And this is the news you need to know. Well, Chase, a three-judge panel for the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in D.C. has ruled that the Department of Justice can reopen its investigation into the National Association of Realtors. In an opinion filed last Friday, Circuit Court judges Florence Pan and Karen Henderson ruled that the settlement agreement reached by the DOJ and NAR in November of 2020 does not prevent the DOJ from reopening its investigation into the trade group's participation rule and clear cooperation policy. Now, at the center of the debate is a letter the DOJ sent to NAR back in November of 2020, in which the DOJ agreed to close its investigation into NAR. Part of the opinion given by two of these judges is that the plain meaning of that provision is that DOJ closed its then-pending investigation and relieved NAR of its obligation to respond to two specifically identified civil investigative demands. And then she went on to say, we discern no commitment by DOJ, express or implied, to refrain from either opening a new investigation or reopening its closed investigation, which might entail issuing new CIDs related to NAR's policies. Now, put simply, the fact that DOJ closed its investigation does not guarantee that the investigation would stay closed forever. The words close and reopen are unambiguously compatible. Chase, what do you think of this?
Well, there's a lot of legal mumbo jumbo, for lack of a better way of describing it, in this article, Bruce. I leave it to the lawyers. Well, first of all, let's be clear. The DOJ and NAR have been locking horns for years. And to think that they're never going to lock horns again, whether it's over the same thing or something new, would be a little naive, I think, on our part, regardless of what was, you know, put on a moratorium, so to speak, if you will, or closed or reopened. That's really what the debate is here, right? And matter of fact, it just goes to show a part of the what the attorneys are saying here is that the court will not interpret a contract to cede a sovereign right of the United States unless the government waives that right unmistakably. They're talking about DOJ here. So unless they say, we're never going to open this again, which they didn't, then they haven't ceded the right to do so. So here we are, them locking horns again, a common occurrence over the course of time. But there is some really, really specific information cited in this article, Bruce, that I want to point to, because as we've been back and forth on some of these things, whether it's the NAR lawsuits or DOJ and NAR, a lot of it comes down to intent. And the DOJ was really specific with their underpinning intent, mm-hmm. whether it's of this particular clear cooperation rule that they're citing or otherwise. I'm going to read it right out of the article. There's a quote in the statement. It says, in a statement emailed to the Wall Street Journal, the head of the DOJ's antitrust division said it was committed to fighting to lower the cost of buying and selling a home. I just want to put a pin in that. And then he goes on to say, real estate commissions in the United States greatly exceed those in any other developed economy, and this decision restores the antitrust division's ability to investigate potentially an unlawful conduct by NAR that may be contributing to this problem. That's from Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Cantor. So there you have it, Bruce. That's actually the meat of this story. Not that they're allowed to reopen it, but their intention is to go after NAR as part of lowering the cost of buying and selling a home. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, if there was ever any doubt of their reasoning why, I got to be honest with you, Chase, it's sort of, and we'll talk a little bit about the Sitzer Burnett case, right? And the way the plaintiffs presented how commissions operate in other countries versus the US. And they say that because we charge more, that our system is broken and doesn't work. And in actuality, they weren't comparing apples and apples, right? They were comparing apples to oranges because of the way that the consumer is being charged for those services in those countries. This seems like a broad brushstroke to try and solve a problem or a perceived problem that DOJ has. And again, like you said, DOJ and NAR have been locking horns for years, and specifically over the participation rule and the clear cooperation policy.
Yeah, remember, Bruce, this is the antitrust division, which is like, in essence, making sure that the consumer's protected, that there's transparency and competition, right? There's not monopolies, for example. Mm-hmm. And here's the deal, Bruce. There's 1.6 million realtors. There's plenty of competition. And the transparency to the consumer is as clear and transparent as maybe it's ever been. Right. So I appreciate someone saying, hey, we want to lower the cost of buying and selling real estate. Okay, well, we should make sure that the market can do that with fair competition. And we have that.
Right.
Right. NAR isn't right keeping us from competing on the local level for buyers and sellers. And so it's interesting that, the DOJ is so forthcoming with their intention for these particular investigations.
By the way, it's one dimensional. They're just talking about what they perceive as being a too high a cost. When you start to dig a little deeper and peel the layers of the onion, so to speak, right, what you realize is different groups are going to be disadvantaged differently. And what I mean by that is you've got buyers, for example, VA buyers, who, by the way, should have those benefits. They've served our country, for goodness sake. We need to take care of them. Currently, they can pay no fees, right, in terms of closing a home. And yet now what they're going to do is they're going to force these people to actually have to come up with, otherwise they won't be able to have any representation. And we've already seen what happens when only one party is represented. That's why the law changed back in 1993. So, yeah, I think there's going to be some unintended consequences of all of this, Chase. And I think people get myopic in terms of their focus. And unfortunately, it's going to impact people. We don't seem to be able to have a week's news without reporting on the Sitzer-Burnett trial and the ruling. But I think this is interesting, Chase. The plaintiffs are asking the judge to order Home Services to pay $4.7 billion in damages for the Sitzer-Burnett Commission lawsuit. In a filing earlier this week, Home Services of America asked Judge Stephen Bowe, who is overseeing the Sitzer-Burnett Commission lawsuit, to deny the plaintiff's motion for entry of judgment. Now, in their mid-March filing, the Sitzer-Burnett plaintiffs asked the court to order Home Services of America, the sole remaining defendant in the suit, to pay $4.7 million in damages. Now, this amount is 88% of the treble damages awarded by the Missouri jury in October. Now, Home Services of America called the plaintiff's motion premature, noting that the court has yet to approve the four other settlement agreements reached by other defendants in the lawsuit. The date of the final approval hearing, by the way, for the settlement agreements is set for May 9th of 2024. Now, the brokerage firm argued that if these settlements are rejected or challenged, the math for the final judgment amount would change. In their motion, the plaintiffs said they reached the damages amount by trebling the initial damages award and then subtracting the total amounts of the settlements. So, Chase, what thinks you of this?
Well, it sounds like they're trying to put Home Services on the hook for everything that's not been settled, which is strange because I don't know that that's their portion, if you will. But it makes sense, Bruce. It makes sense what Home Services is actually saying in my mind, which is, and this is part of a quote from their filing, plaintiff's attempt to treat the settlement amounts as effectively final ignores the fact that courts commonly reject class action settlements when reviewing them for fairness, reasonableness, and adequacy. Additionally, Home Services wrote that it does not expect the approval process of the settlement agreement to be smooth. So this goes back to what we were stating before, Bruce, and that is there's a lot more trail to break here. There's a lot more road to be walked down here, if you will, before anything is final. And just because there's a date set even in May, they're saying we don't expect it to go smoothly, and these things are often rejected even though they've been quote-unquote settled. That doesn't mean that'll happen either, but there's a chance for it. So for someone to ask for 88% of these treble damages when there's still a lot of road to walk down seems to be, again, wanting to kind of supersede due process, if you will, right? And the process of what we should be allowed for in the courts, right? It's like, nope, these guys settled, so you should too. And we want the court to go ahead and tell you to pay us, even though you haven't settled. Just ludicrous to me, Bruce.
I think these attorneys are salivating here, Chase. You know, in their motion, they also noted that they're seeking an award of the attorney's fees and the costs of the suit, and interest on the damages amount at a yearly rate of 5.4% starting November 1, the day after the verdict. Now, in its filing, Home Services wrote that the interest on the damages amount should begin accruing on the date Judge Bowe enters in his final judgment. I think this is also interesting that the Home Services filing also notes that the law requires the plaintiffs to demonstrate a danger of hardship if its request is not granted, which Home Services says they failed to do. To me, this just smacks the plaintiff attorney greed. This is why they're pushing to get this thing done. We've reported previously, Chase, they've said that everyone's knocking on their door to come and settle. Right, this isn't the only lawsuit this particular firm has actually filed. They think they've won the lottery and they want to collect their winnings.
Part of me hopes that Home Services is right. There's a lot more to be settled out here in terms of finalizing anything.
Well, and I think, Chase, to that end, right? So Home Services has also said that they're still dealing with their post-trial motions. And besides those post-trial motions, Home Services is also waiting to hear from the U.S. Supreme Court, who they've petitioned asking for a review of an August 2023 ruling by the Eighth Circuit Court, which found that Home Services could not enforce arbitration agreements signed by sellers' clients of its franchisees. The appeals court said that this was because the contracts signed by the sellers were not directly signed by Home Services. So it would seem to me, Chase, that Home Services is looking at this as their out, where they're saying, hey, look, you know what? We're not a party to the commission. We're not a party to the agreement between the sellers and the agents or the franchisees, which will be interesting if they actually win this, because what does that mean for their franchisees?
It's a big question, Bruce. Scary one I'd be afraid to answer at this point.
Well, Chase, finally, millennials have replaced baby boomers as the largest group of home buyers in 2023. The combined share of millennials, both younger, and those are the ages 25 to 33, and older millennials, which are considered 34 to 43 years of age, made up a combined 38% of the home purchase market last year. And that's up from 28% in 2022. And that's according to the 2024 Home Buyers and Sellers Generational Trends Report from NAR. Meanwhile, baby boomers, comprising both younger boomers aged 59 to 68 and older boomers ages 69 to 77, saw their share of the home sales decrease from 39% down to 31% during the same period. What goes through your mind on this?
Well, it feels like a win for me, Bruce, because I'm a millennial, technically. And I'm definitely on the very high side of millennials. I barely made it in, and I'm not even sure if that's good or not. But, you know, a 10% change is pretty dramatic over the course of a year. You know, although you expect these things to happen, they happen naturally as time progresses, right? Eventually, one generation takes over the other generation, primarily because millennials are now in some of their prime earning stages and they've gotten to a place in life where they've saved money and want to buy a house, or they've already done that and now they're move-up buyers, right? They're buying a bigger house, their families may be expanding, et cetera. And so it makes sense eventually for a generation to be more active than the previous, right? Because you have boomers who are still in the market. Certainly, you know, 31% was still a large percentage of the purchases, but they're gradually transacting less just because of age, right? That makes sense, I think, to anyone listening. So it is interesting to see, right? And from a real estate agent perspective, I think one of the questions we have to ask is, how are we positioning ourselves to well care for and create a great customer experience for different types of buyers and sellers? Because people in different generations sometimes have different expectations of what they want that customer experience to look like, right? You think of like older boomers, for example, they probably, a lot of them might still want to meet in person and sign paperwork with a pen, right? Versus maybe some of the younger millennials saying, hey, no, just send it over electronically and I'll click, click, click. And away we go, right? And actually, as a real estate agent, we need to be able to offer both options. And I'm just using those as examples because that's what the client wants. That's what the consumer expects in that generation. So there's some interesting information here, Bruce, that I think real estate agents can really use to their advantage and make sure that they're able to navigate those different types of experiences that are expected.
You know, I agree with you, Chase. I think that's the question, right, is how do you put yourself in opportunity's way? And I thought was really interesting here, the report highlights a surge in first-time homebuyers across all age groups, right, with millennials leading the charge. Notably, 32% of all buyers in 2023 were first-timers. And that's up from 26% in the prior year, with millennials comprising 75% of that demographic. What I think is really interesting is that older millennials and Generation X, right, which are those people aged 44 to 58, also saw significant representation among first-time buyers, respectively accounting for 44 and 24% of that group. So one, I think it's really fascinating that we're seeing it first-time home buyers of an older age group, right, getting in there. So how do you put yourself in opportunity's way to take advantage of these first-time home buyers? And to your point, Chase, of dealing with people, right, younger ones liking the electronic, which is really interesting you say that, because my youngest daughter, her and her husband are looking to buy a house right now, and they want all of their communication with their realtor to be via text. They're not really into the phone call thing or the conversation. They just text it to me. But I thought what was interesting is Generation Z, right, which are those people 18 to 24, and as we would expect, it should be a smaller amount, but they only account for 3% of all buyers right now.
Right now.
And what I thought was interesting is 31% were single women, which is a significantly higher proportion than any other age group. So again, how do we position ourselves as real estate professionals to go support the demographic that we want to go and chase?
Yeah, I think that's a great question that every real estate professional needs to be answering, Bruce. And there's multiple ways to do that, by the way. There's not just one answer. That's the good news. But you do need to answer it for your business. There's some other data in here, Bruce, that I think is really encouraging to our realtor friends here listening, and that is homeownership continues to be perceived as a sound financial investment by 82% of all buyers surveyed by NAR, especially younger millennials. Across all generations, the role of real estate agents also remains pivotal, contrary to all the lawsuits and DOJ, what they would have you thinking.
Yeah, that we report all the time, yeah.
Yeah, 9 in 10 buyers express willingness to enlist their agent services again or recommend them to others, which means that by and large, real estate professionals are delivering a great experience to their clients and that the consumer still highly, highly values the representation of a professional real estate agent. And that's good news all the way around.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that I think is important to know, right, if we look at the median amount of time people are spending in their home among all buyers, it was actually 10 years before selling. But older millennials sold their homes after a median stay of just 6 years. Meanwhile, Gen X, baby boomers, and the silent generation, which are 78 and beyond, right, typically stayed in their homes for 15 years. So we're seeing the older generations are staying longer and the younger generations are staying in their homes much shorter amount of time. So again, what does your database look like? Is it made up of baby boomers and beyond, or is it made up of younger and older millennials? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I don't know if you've moved lately, Bruce, but that's a young person's sport. That's a lot of work, right? And even as an older millennial, the older I get, the less that I just want that, you know, distraction in my life. Whereas I used to move every couple of years, right? And that served me pretty well, but it was a lot of work. So it makes sense. And I hear what you're saying, Bruce, all joking aside, if you're not paying attention to how the mix, if you will, of your database, then there's just a chance that you're missing out on opportunity that is all around you, right? Think about the first-time homebuyer. 32% last year, a third basically of all purchases were first-time homebuyers. So if you've carved out this niche to where all you're doing is selling homes for baby boomers, unless that's exactly what you want, then good for you. You're missing out on a third of the transactions or a third of the buyers out there that are transacting right now. So again, that might be a choice, but if you're looking to broaden and grow your business, paying attention to the mix of your database would be worthwhile.
Well, that's the news you need to know. Don't miss this Friday's Northern Lights episode where we'll interview Jennifer Moratti with Keller Williams Greater 360 in Poolsbo, Washington. Thanks again for tuning in with us on The Real Look.
This podcast is produced by Marissa Frost. Visit kwnwr.com to access the show notes from today's episode. Head over to Apple, Google, or Spotify, or really any major streaming platform to subscribe, and don't forget to leave us a review. Thanks again for listening to The Real Look.